I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of August. All things political, Mondays at 1 o'clock, and today it's with Molly Ball. Molly covers national politics for The Atlantic. She has written several articles recently on immigration reform, the groups behind the big fight to stop immigration reform, the groups in favor of reform, and the signs that reform is gaining momentum to overcome the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. U.S. embassies reopened yesterday, except for one in Yemen's capital. The U.S. has carried out 9 drone strikes in that country since July 28. And we ask a couple questions. How effective are those strikes and how big a threat is Al-Qaeda now? Attorney General Eric Holder today calling for changes to the criminal justice system and how drug offenses are handled. He favors diverting people convicted of low-level offenses to drug treatment and community service programs. A few of the topics we'll be covering this hour, plus whatever you deem worthy of conversation with Molly. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can do that Twitter thing, too, at K Dunn Show. Also, we'll talk about presidential politics. I'm sorry, but it's happening. Joe Biden going to Iowa in September for Senator Tom Harkin's steak fry fundraiser. And Hillary Clinton was in Iowa at a Madam President symposium. Molly is with us now. Molly is, as I said, a staff writer for The Atlantic. She also used to write for Politico, the Las Vegas Review Journal, and the Las Vegas Sun, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. Hello, Molly.
Hi, Kathleen.
Thank you very much for being with us. And I really like the name Molly. Isn't that a good name? I was just thinking about that. What a nice name.
My parents will be thrilled to hear that. Thank you. Yeah, it's always worked out well for me.
Good. Please tell them. Well, let's start with immigration reform. You have written extensively about this, and I'm wondering what's happening in the town hall meetings all over the country when members of Congress who are on vacation for a long time now are listening to constituents. What are they hearing concerning immigration reform? Who's the most organized?
Well, I don't think we quite know yet. As you know, members of Congress are going to be home all month, and they're going to be having these town halls until the end of the month. So I think it would be too soon to sort of say which way this thing is going. But what we do know is that both sides are very actively organized to try to create a presence at these town halls. You know, once upon a time, not to be nostalgic, but the congressional town hall meeting was an actual event where members of Congress could just sort of meet in a casual setting with their constituents and sort of reach out and take the pulse. Now it's this sort of highly orchestrated political pressure point where groups on both sides of any given issue, and it's certainly not just immigration, are trying to create a spectacle and trying to put pressure on people, on members of Congress. So you have this very organized attempt by proponents of immigration reform. They're trying to get small businesses in these members' districts, as well as Hispanic activists and just plain old constituents to show up. And then on the other side, you have the activists who want to stop the quote-unquote amnesty bill, who are mobilizing their supporters to show up at their member of Congress and speak to them about their point of view. So anecdotally, I've seen a lot of reports that it seems like the pro-immigration reform side is more organized, but I think it's too soon to say that.
I remember Senator Russ Feingold talking about the last re-election campaign of his, and he was saying that he couldn't believe how many people were there to really shout about health care reform, that those listening sessions all over the state were something quite different a couple years ago. And I'm wondering if we'll see some of the same on immigration or if it will be toned down a bit.
Well, that is absolutely the goal. Everybody remembers those 2009 town hall meetings when particularly Democrats went home to their districts and just got an earful that really surprised them. They did not realize there was this building wave of grassroots Tea Party anger focused on Obamacare And it really shook them. It really impressed them with the level of passion and made it much harder, I think, to get that bill through. So both sides of the immigration fight want to be responsible for that happening on immigration. At the same time, you also have anti-Obamacare groups organizing. You have groups concerned with other issues organizing. So I think now it's sort of too much of a known quantity, this sort of phenomenon of organizing for the August recess, for anyone to be surprised by it.
Molly, what are the indications you have that immigration reform may be able to get through the Republican House of Representatives?
Well, about a month ago, the entire Republican caucus of the House of Representatives had a meeting, closed-door meeting, no staff, just members of Congress, meeting with their leadership to sort of take the pulse of where they were going to go on this. There was not a sort of conclusive takeaway from that. But what John Boehner did say was, we have to act. The House will not do nothing. Now, the House is not going to take up the Senate bill. Boehner has also been very clear about that. But proponents of immigration reform were tremendously encouraged to hear him say, this isn't something we feel we can just drop. Boehner is believed to be himself sort of a soft supporter of immigration reform, defined as a comprehensive bill or series of bills that includes both border security and some kind of path to citizenship for those undocumented immigrants currently living in the U.S. Paul Ryan, who you may have heard of,
yes,
there in Wisconsin,
yes, we have.
Has emerged as quite a strong supporter of immigration reform. And he's very powerful within the caucus, has a lot of credibility with both the grassroots and the conservatives, as well as the sort of more mainstream establishment Republicans, both in Congress and outside of it. And, you know, he came up with Jack Kemp, who was a strong proponent of the economic benefits of immigration. And so he believes deeply that this is something that needs to be done. And I think he really does have the power to bring along a lot of people in that very divided and chaotic House Republican Congress.
I've noticed, and you've written about this, that there are some ads that are running in Wisconsin that are anti-Congressman Paul Ryan on immigration. Are these common all over the country, these kinds of ads, and who's behind them?
There are a lot of ads running on both sides of this issue. Against immigration reform, all of the ads are being funded by this network of grassroots groups. The most prominent is called Numbers USA. And this is a group that is not just against illegal immigration, but is against immigration, period. It wants to reduce the number of people who are allowed to come into the United States. They are being vastly outspent, however. They're about three times as much money is being spent in favor of immigration reform. And it's by a sort of broad coalition of but largely business groups. The Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg has a group advocating for immigration reform, and it is airing ads all over the country. There are other sort of Chamber of Commerce affiliated groups that are airing pro-immigration reform ads. So it's actually the pro-reform side that has the financial and advertising advantage here.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, I can't believe we're doing this, but let's talk about
okay.
The presidential race in 2016, even though it's 2013, isn't it? Hillary Clinton in Iowa at a Madam President of all names symposium. Joe Biden is going to Iowa in September for Senator Tom Harkin's annual fundraiser, the Steak Fest Fry. What do you think about the two of them? And let's start with Hillary Clinton, who's getting an enormous amount of attention. I'm wondering if you think that she will be the nominee, and could she win?
I hate to predict anything, because certainly a lot of people looked stupid when they said Hillary Clinton was inevitable back in 2006, right? But it is hard to see from here, without anything changing, how she doesn't get the Democratic nomination if she wants it. She just is so widely loved now within the Democratic coalition. You see these polls where she beats anybody else in the field by 40 or 50 points. And I think there's a couple things going on there, right? She lost the 2008 nomination because Barack Obama had the grassroots passion. And even though she sort of had the establishment sewed up, she didn't have that fire. Now that she has served in the Obama administration, those Obama grassroots supporters regard her much more fondly, and she has a real grassroots following among the Democratic rank and file, particularly a lot of Democratic partisans who admire her work in the Obama administration and would like to see a woman president. So I think there's another part of that story, however, which is that the Democrats have a tremendously weak bench of presidential aspirants or potential contenders. You have all these big names on the Republican side, for, you know, Chris Christie and Marco Rubio and a dozen other people, Paul Ryan, who are quite well regarded and well positioned. Beyond Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, it's really a bunch of no names on the Democratic side. There really are not a bunch of extremely qualified Democrats who are in a good position to run.
What about Joe Biden?
Well, I think Joe Biden would be well positioned if Hillary Clinton decided not to run. Joe Biden has run twice before in the past and has some well-known liabilities from that process. He also will be rather advanced in years by the time the 2016 race comes around. So Joe Biden's much more of an unknown quantity for me in terms of how Democrats regard him, right? There's a sense that the Democratic base sees him as sort of the goofy uncle of the Obama administration.
Right.
I don't know if that would translate into sort of a serious support for a presidential campaign.
And we were saying after the last election that the Republicans were going to have to come up with a strategy to attract new voters and also with some deep philosophical conversations as to what the party stands for right now. When you mentioned Chris Christie and Paul Ryan, there are some who would say the two of them have very different philosophies. There's a conservative wing of the party. There's a more moderate wing of the party. Have they had those soul-searching conversations in order to win back the presidency, do you think?
I think all of this is still going on, and it is not going to be pretty. But, you know, we saw Chris Christie and Rand Paul all but coming to blows recently over national security policy and foreign policy. And that to me seemed like a very healthy thing. Even if you don't want to be having the 2016 primary in 2013, which I understand, this is a sort of philosophical hashing out and conversation that the Republicans need to have within between their different factions if they want to settle anything and come up with a new identity for the party and a way forward. So there are going to be these conflicts over ideology, and that represents also an advance from what started out as a conversation mostly about strategy, right? How could we have built a better technological operation in the 2012 campaign and then Mitt Romney would have won? I think if they had kept the conversation on that level and not made it a conversation about policy, there would be much less of a chance that the party would actually be able to move forward.
Let's go to one more area and then we'll move to phone calls. U.S. embassies reopening yesterday. The one in Yemen's capital has remained closed. 9 drone strikes in Yemen since July 28. A couple questions for you. The president is taking some heat for these drone strikes. Are they effective, Molly? And do we have any idea how big a threat al-Qaeda is right now?
This is not really my area, so I'm not going to overstate my own knowledge about all this. I think the politics of this, which is what I do more report on, is very interesting because you do have a president who, let's not forget, was elected as an anti-war candidate. And another big reason Hillary Clinton lost that primary
right.
was her vote in favor of the Iraq War, which
right.
she declined to apologize for. One thing that I can see happening if Hillary Clinton does decide to run is there will be a bit of a backlash on the left because she is possibly even more conservative than Obama on foreign policy and on national security. And that's the most prominent area of Obama's presidency that has really angered his base, that has
yes.
really riled up the left against him. And particularly if the Republicans run somebody like Rand Paul, who is really far to the left on these issues, we could see a real sort of mold-breaking debate on where the United States ought to be going with not only questions of war and peace and intervention, but also civil liberties.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised, Molly, that this president has ruled in such a conservative fashion when it comes to foreign policy? Did you see that coming?
I did not see it coming. And I think a lot of the sort of progressive left didn't see it coming. And that's part of why they're so chagrined by this. They felt like in electing someone who was a constitutional law professor who has thought deeply about these legal questions, I think there was a feeling that he was poised to reverse what were seen as the abuses of the Bush administration on, you know, obviously he pledged quite conspicuously to close Guantanamo. He says he still wants to do that, but that certainly hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the alleged civil rights abuses of the Bush administration have been carried on by the Obama administration. So I think in the civil liberties community that really thought they had an ally in Barack Obama, there's been a lot of disillusionment.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Molly Ball is our guest for All Things Political this hour. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers national politics, and she has written a good deal about immigration reform lately. She also wrote a very interesting piece. We'll get to her on this. Are seniors souring on the Republican Party? She talks about just 28% of voters 65 and older having a favorable view of the Republican Party in a national survey that was conducted last month by a Democratic pollster, but he's a pretty reliable Democratic pollster. And this is a shift that Republicans, seniors, seem to be turning against the Republican Party. We'll ask her about the polls that she's been observing and why that is happening. And we have other issues to talk about nationally with Attorney General Eric Holder today calling for changes to the criminal justice system, particularly for low-level drug offenses. Prisons in this country are really filled with people who are there because of drug offenses. Is this something that will go over well with the American public or not? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org, Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also send us a tweet at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for All Things Political with Molly Ball, staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers national politics. Willem in Colfax, our first caller. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I was just concerned about the debate on immigration reform. I think that Americans should be prepared to pay a lot more for their food and other services if we're going to restrict the labor that comes from Central America and Mexico. Many of them who work on farms in California or pick fruit in Michigan or clean hotel rooms all over this nation. So I think it's sort of unrealistic to act like, it's so much a part of this economy, these laborers that come from Central America and Mexico and other places who take these low-wage jobs that Americans don't seem to want to work for, or they're going to have to raise the wages to a level that Americans would be willing to accept and work for, because it's just, it's part of this whole, I think, right-wing agenda of pitting one group of workers against other workers in a divide-and-conquer strategy that our current governor seems to be very much a part of.
Thanks, Willem, for the call. Molly?
I would say that that's certainly part of the argument that the proponents of immigration reform have made. And the opponents tend to argue that it would depress wages to allow more immigrants to come into the United States. And most economists do feel that at least in the short term, at the lower end of the wage spectrum, there is that possibility. The Congressional Budget Office did a study of the economic effects of the Senate bill that is on the table and found that it would have a tremendously positive impact on the U.S. economy as a whole. And in fact, that was sort of cited as a pretext by the Senate in adding a tremendous amount of spending for border security, that because the economy is going to grow so much because of legalization in particular, that there will be all this money available to Congress to beef up border security. But the whole debate over what immigration does to the economy is a very conflicting and difficult one.
The whole issue of trying to get anything passed when it comes to any piece of legislation, it also seems to be particularly difficult. I can't remember where I was reading yesterday. Maybe you read the same thing, that John Boehner is so frustrated because he can't get anything, can't get his party together on any issue, that he was contemplating quitting. Have you heard that?
I've heard it as something sort of going around Capitol Hill. I don't know that it deserves any particular credence. But, you know, if I were John Boehner, I'd sure hate my job. The Washington
Right.
Post did an analysis
Right.
of, I think, the top six or seven most crucial votes that the House Republicans have had since the beginning of this particular Congress in January. And only 20% of the House Republicans were with Boehner on all of those votes.
There Oh, my goodness.
Only one in five of the majority caucus in the House is actually loyal enough to the guy that he can count on them when he needs them for a tough vote. So, you know, it is no secret that there are deep divisions in the House Republican conference, that Boehner has virtually no control over the House Republicans, and he's got a really tough gig if he wants to actually get anything done. Now, if he doesn't want to get anything done, that's easy.
Right.
But, you know, we see the approval ratings of congressional Republicans tanking, hurting the Republican brand across the board. Democrats have become more and more vocal and I think successful about sort of blaming Republicans for Washington dysfunction. Something a pollster said to me the other day was, you know, we have these focus groups where we ask swing voters or moderate voters, who do you blame for gridlock? And it used to be a sort of pox on all their houses, right? Democrats, Republicans, doesn't matter. It's a Washington problem.
Right.
Increasingly, more and more these days, what they are hearing in those focus groups is this is Republicans' fault. And so there's a lot of fear among the Republican establishment that the chaos in the Republican Congress is hurting Republicans everywhere.
Considering the divisions in the party, would you say that the party would be hard-pressed to find another speaker who might be more popular, who would be able to do a job, unite people? Or are the divisions so deep that that's virtually impossible?
You know, that's impossible to know. I think it is what saved Boehner last time, when there was a speaker's election back in January and there were quite a few votes against him. But the whole dump Boehner movement within the Republican caucus didn't get any traction because they didn't have a candidate. There was no one waiting on the sidelines. Now, some people will tell you, and this gets deep into sort of congressional Kremlinology, but some people will tell you that Eric Cantor wants that job. He has yet to sort of really move in, though, and openly challenge Boehner for it. And because, as you say, so many of the challenges Boehner faces are structural and not specific to him personally, there's a lot of reasons that any other Republican member of Congress would look at his job and say, better him than me.
Mm-hmm, right.
I wouldn't want that job either.
Right. We're talking all things political this hour, as we always do Monday at 1 o'clock. We've brought up a few topics, but feel free to broaden our conversation. You can call us on the Ideas Network, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's go to Pat in Wauwatosa. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how you doing, guys?
All right, Pat.
You know, I can't believe we're talking about 2016 already.
I know.
I'm clearing my hangover from 2012. you know, one of the things that I find very, very frustrating, and I'm definitely left-leaning, but center and kind of conservative on economic issues, is the fact that, you know, the Republican Party, and aided by the media, is really continuing this mythology that the economy is under better stewardship with the Republican Party, yet we've always seen deficits balloon and the economy, you know, undergo, you know, contractions, high unemployment. And the other, you know, the other thing too is, especially coming out of the 2012 election, the Republicans are like, you know, looking at each other going, what did we do wrong? What did we do wrong? Well, you know, it's kind of mean-spiritedness, quite frankly, and that's not getting enough play in the media, I don't think. If you're cued into the social stream, you know, on the net, You see this discussed all the time. It's hateful invective, you know, segregating rhetoric, and it's not aided by Supreme Court decisions gutting the Voting Rights Act and really a faithful stewardship of the neocon agenda by the Obama administration. You know, Obama has not been the civil libertarian, as you mentioned previously, and as a former constitutional law professor, I find it absolutely remarkable, his continued support of drone strikes. So it's really interesting to see all this going on. And for 2016, I can't see how the Democrats couldn't win. And I'll take your commentary off.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks for your thoughtful comments. Molly?
Well, I think I don't see how the Republicans win this one falls into the sort of famous last words category, right? There is a possibility that Democrats get a little bit cocky with their perceived electoral advantage as things stand now. One of the things I wrote about recently was looking back at what the Democrats went through in the 1980s, where they were in a plight with almost eerie parallels to what faces Republicans now, losing 5 out of 6 presidential popular votes in a row, having, you know, a majority in Congress, but being sort of wiped out everywhere else, and really being on the wrong side of almost all the issues. If you look at the polling on everything from taxes to social issues, the majorities are mostly on the sort of Democratic Party side of things right now. And they were on the Republican side of things back in the 1980s. There was a lot of hand-wringing. There were some very bloody battles on the left. And what emerged out of that, sort of phoenix from the ashes style, was Bill Clinton, a Southern Democrat with a moderate philosophy who was committed to changing the Democratic Party's tone on a lot of these issues in order to speak to middle America rather than speaking to the far left of his party. And so, you know, in going from 1989, when it looked like Democrats might never win another national election ever again, to 1992, when, of course, they did win, it was a combination of one of the most talented politicians that America has seen in probably the last 50 years and a real change in ideology and philosophical orientation that he led his party to. So, again, the Republican Party has a lot of very promising politicians right now. They've got a lot of political talent. It's a question of, can one of those figures win a primary and lead his or her party in a new direction? Because if that can happen, then anything is possible, and it could happen in a pretty short time.
And yet the Republicans also have to worry. You wrote a very interesting piece recently, Molly, about whether or not seniors are souring on the Republican Party. What's that all about?
This is a really interesting trend that a Democratic pollster, Stan Greenberg, has started picking up in a series of national surveys that he's done. Now, you can take that with a grain of salt because it is a Democratic pollster. But Republican pollsters that I spoke to did not question that this is actually going on just because the Republican brand is in so much trouble everywhere. But the senior citizens, voters 65 and over, have been the strongest group for the Republican Party. Most of the hand-wringing has been about, oh my gosh, we're losing the youth vote, we're losing minorities, we're losing women. But at least we can count on, right, if you went to any Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan presidential events last year, it looked like an old folks' home most of the time. And a lot of the postmortems that have been done since 2012 have slammed Republicans for being sort of the party of old white people. Well, they may even be losing the old white people, and that would really be a problem. This poll finds that they're losing more ground among seniors than any other demographic group. Any race or gender or age category. It's plummeting. And as of 2011, Republican, the question, you know, which party do you view this party favorably or unfavorably? Republicans had the advantage. 43% viewed Republicans favorably. Only 37% of seniors viewed Democrats favorably. That was 2011. Fast forward to today. Now, the Republican number is just 28%, and the Democratic number is 40%. So you have Republicans losing ground, Democrats gaining ground with this group of older voters.
One of your sources said the economy may be the biggest underlying factor in this shift. Would you agree with that assessment?
I think it has to be, just because the economy is still the number one issue on everybody's mind. Voters across the board in absolutely every group are still most concerned about the economy, far more than immigration or gun control or gay marriage or any of the other sort of hot button issues that we talk about. The economy is still first and foremost on people's minds. And Republicans, as the caller pointed out, have not succeeded in repositioning themselves away from this sort of party of the rich, party of the 1% orientation that was so toxic for Mitt Romney last year. So I do think it's mostly about the economy. It's also about the Ryan budget. Obviously, so much of the Democrats' messaging in 2012 with seniors was about Paul Ryan wanting to take away your Medicare. Of course, that's right. Not true. The Ryan plan specifically exempts seniors and those who are already on Medicare. But any kind of change to Medicare is seen as sort of disconcerting to seniors who rely on the program. And there's a sense that those attacks are resonating.
Thanks, Pat, for the call. Ed in West Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Good afternoon. If you'd like to see and witness the disillusionment of organized labor with President Barack Obama, I suggest that you come in here to the hinterland, to southeastern Wisconsin, and see how this president, who had this promise to us in 2008, which has now gone unfulfilled, of the Employee Free Choice Act, which was only a drop in the bucket to get us back to national strength and prominence, can't and won't articulate a vision for organized labor, and he only has 3 years left. This has become a part-time economy. People are working three jobs to sustain their lives, and it's unacceptable. And we have a president who consumed the first year and three quarters of his life as president on health care and totally forgot about the promise to organize labor. And if organized labor is not strengthened, this nation is going to continue to wither and die and be in a state of perpetual anarchy, as we're witnessing nightly.
Molly.
This is a really interesting call. I think the labor movement really is at a crossroads. And the problem, which isn't really new for them, is that they're hardly going to go and vote Republican. And so, as we've seen with Card Check, the Employee Free Choice Act that the caller mentioned, there isn't a tremendous amount of urgency by the president or among Democrats to make that happen. Now, granted, there probably aren't the votes, so it might be pointless to try. But it is also true that Republicans are far more hostile to everything from Card Check to the president's nominee to head the Labor Department. So I think you have a lot of progressive members of the progressive coalition, whether it's the civil liberties advocates who we talked about before or members of organized labor, who are feeling a little bit trapped, feeling like Democrats may not have delivered for them, but the Republicans, in their view, are so much worse that, you know, I heard a lot of grumbling from organized labor throughout President Obama's first term, where he hadn't passed Card Check, he hadn't come through on a lot of other things. But when it came time for his reelection campaign, they looked across at the other side, they sort of swallowed hard, and they mobilized as hard as they possibly could. I mean, look at Wisconsin. There's arguably no bigger epicenter for the fights between sort of the right and organized labor than what's happened with your governor. And it is, and it's the case there as well, that the unions mobilized as hard as they could, and they were not strong enough to defeat Scott Walker. And so I think there's a real question and a real worry in the union movement about their declining clout and whether Democrats are going to follow through on their promises to labor.
And we thank you very much, Ed, for your call. Our phone number, and we have lines open for you right now. We're doing all things political. We do this Mondays now at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Molly Ball is our guest. Molly is a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers national politics. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Ed mentioned health care reform, which, of course, is still being debated in Congress, even though it is the law of the land and the Supreme Court has upheld most of it. Why are some Republicans still on this issue? And what do you think it'll mean for the country and for politics once some of this goes into effect? Will it be substantial enough for people to like it?
Well, that's the gazillion-dollar question, right? I mean, I think those healthcare town halls that we were talking about before in 2009, where this issue mobilized the grassroots on the right in a way that surprised both parties, that really convinced Republicans that this was a winning issue for them and that they could not give any ground. Mm-hmm. And so you have Republicans, you know, the House voting, I think, 40 times now to repeal all or part of the Affordable Care Act. And now a substantial number of members of the House and Senate saying they plan to shut down the government if the Democrats won't agree to defund Obamacare. A lot of other Republicans warning against this, saying it's a losing fight and it's just going to blow up in the Republicans' face. But they know that their grassroots feels very, very strongly that this is the last chance to stop Obamacare, which, of course, goes into effect for the most part next year. So to that end, there's also been a lot of efforts to mess with the implementation of the law, whether it's by encouraging the healthy young people who are the most sort of the largest pool of uninsured people currently, encouraging them not to sign up. The Republican governors who have refused to participate with their states, either accepting the Medicare dollars or starting these exchanges, Medicaid, excuse me. And so there's a real attempt to derail the law before it starts. And Democrats know that a lot is riding on the rollout of this. If it's really rocky mm-hmm. and it goes really badly, that could create a sort of political mandate for, you know, a Republican majority in both houses and another Republican president to come in and get rid of the whole thing. If the implementation is somewhat successful, or even if it just doesn't disturb most people, the people who already have health insurance and would just prefer that things stay the same. If that goes well, then I think Republicans are right that this will have been their last chance and it will be a political non-starter anytime in the future, just as it is now with Social Security, which was contentious in much the same way when it began. It will no longer be possible to get rid of this law.
800-486-8655, our number. All Things Political is what you're listening to on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls in a moment. Hour two of our program today. This has been a very violent week. Lots of shootings and 8 deaths as a result of shootings last week alone in the city of Milwaukee. We'll be talking about Milwaukee's Safe and Sound program, started a number of years ago to reduce crime, violent crime particularly. It operates in 21 city of Milwaukee neighborhoods. I have noticed those neighborhoods are now being targeted by many more police officers who are believing that their presence certainly will make a difference. Safe and Sound works by providing places for young people, safe places. They do neighborhood organizing, and they also work with the Milwaukee Police Department on tough law enforcement. We'll speak with the director, Barbara Notstein, and we'll also speak with Taliba Mateen Hooper, a community partner organizer who works with residents. So that's coming up, hour number two of our show. Molly Ball is here now, staff writer for The Atlantic, covers national politics, and we have a number of phone calls. Let us go to KC in Green Bay next. Hi, KC.
Okay, I'll make it real brief because I think a lot of people waiting. Thank you for taking my
call.
The Democratic Party cannot count on union votes anymore. They've let them down so many times. Of course, I live in Wisconsin. If you have a Republican governor, the union has no power whatsoever in the state, and they just can't count on it blindly getting the union vote anymore. It's not going to happen. I talk to many union people every day. They won't vote Democratic, and they're too let down. It used to be automatic in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. If you were union, you were straight-line Democrat. You didn't even look at the ballot. You just marked everything to the Democratic Party. Those days are over. The Democratic Party's in big trouble if they think they can rely on the union vote. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Casey, very much for the call. We spent a lot of time talking about the votes that Republicans need. It is true, in terms of votes, unions used to go Democratic. Their strength is really diminished, which is probably pretty devastating to Democrats, isn't it?
It could be, but the face of the union movement also is changing. And with respect to this caller and the other one, the sort of Rust Belt manufacturing industrial unions that powered the union movement in the 20th century are not necessarily the face of the union movement anymore. You know, the majority of union members of this country now are public sector workers. We, of course, saw that in Wisconsin, the teachers, the police and firefighters, a big part of the protests against Scott Walker, and that's true nationwide. It's also true that as our economy becomes more and more a service economy rather than a manufacturing economy, service workers are much more the face of the union movement. I used to be a reporter in Nevada, in Las Vegas, where the largest union in the state is the culinary union of the hotel workers on the Las Vegas Strip. Now, those workers don't look like the sort of old stereotype of the sort of Reagan Democrat union member in the Midwest, the frankly middle-aged white guys with mustaches and pot bellies who I've seen at union halls at Democratic campaign events in places like Ohio and Wisconsin. In the Southwest, you have service workers, very likely to be Hispanic, very likely to be women. It's really a time of change for the labor movement as a whole. Their numbers are declining, but it's also true that their demographics are changing. And so I think some of these economic shifts are much bigger than just the sort of political question of what have the Democrats done for us lately. Some of the sort of angst that you hear from within the labor movement has to do with those internal pressures as well.
Larry in West Bend, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Given the gridlock between the two parties and nothing seeming to be getting done, is it realistic to think that we'll have an option of a third party sometime in the near future?
That's a great question. I wish I knew. It doesn't look good. You know, there aren't any third parties that are really poised to capitalize on what's happening, and it's very hard to start a political party from scratch in this country. We even had, in the last election in 2012, this very well-funded effort called Americans Elect that had tens of millions of dollars and was trying to field a candidate and secure ballot access, and the whole thing sort of fell apart. There was this sort of amorphous yearning for an alternative to the two-party system that everybody hates so much, but nobody could agree on what form it would take. And so I think if you're going to have a third party, that's going to be the problem. There's a lot of people who don't like the Democrats or the Republicans, but do they have anything else in common? Do they agree on any of the issues? Do they have a common vision for what they would like to see replace the Democrats and Republicans? Or is it just this sort of generic feeling that they're both terrible? I tend to think it's more the latter. And so I think besides all the institutional obstacles, the money and the ballot access and the fact that the parties in this country just still really have a monopoly on the process, I think that's what you would run into is it's not enough to just hate the same things. You have to believe in something as well.
Thanks, Larry. Victor in Oconomowoc. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. So you were mentioning the health care law, and it brings up some very interesting points about the Republican Party. They're opposing it wholeheartedly, which is ironic because the Obamacare Patient Protection American Affordability Care Act is the 1993 Republican Senator Chafee alternative to Hillary Care, point by point. So they are being hypocrites because they're the Republicans, because they're opposing something that they came up with to begin with because of a sense of social responsibility, take responsibility for your costs. and they don't want to have a socialism, you know, program that makes us all takers, not takers. One final point I want to make. If you look at the blue states versus the red states, who pays more taxes, who gets more welfare, the blue states are funding the red states. The red states take in lots of government welfare from the blue states, so the Republicans aren't just hypocrites. They're big-time hypocrites. Thank you, and I'll take your response off.
Thanks, Victor, for the call. Molly.
Well, it certainly is true that the form that Obama's health care reform took was very much inspired by the conservative position on health care reform back in the 90s. And I think this is actually kind of an example of Democrats, as they have tacked to the middle, increasingly moving into the what used to be the conservative policy space, so that this is part of the problem that Republicans have in presenting a constructive agenda that actually includes solutions, legislative solutions for America's problems. In a lot of cases, Democrats have sort of co-opted those things. Another example would be cap and trade. That was the conservative policy alternative to Democratic environmental policies. And then Democrats said, OK, we'll do that. That we'll be the ones in favor of sort of market-oriented environmental law. And so that's the case with healthcare now. And most notoriously, Mitt Romney proposed an individual mandate-based, market-based healthcare reform that was a private system that didn't include a government health plan. And Democrats decided that that's what they would do. And then Republicans turned against it. There aren't that many individual Republicans that are necessarily being hypocrites about this. And I do think that the opposition on the part of a lot of the Republican grassroots is sincere. They really do worry about government encroachment on individual liberty. And there's a lot of worry about what this will do to the current individual health insurance market. But I think this is part of the problem the Republican Party is having, is that when you say to them, what are you for? We know what you are against, but what is it that you are for? What are the solutions you are proposing? There certainly is not a unified voice from the party that can say this is our agenda. And even on a sort of individual basis, there are not a lot of Republican policymakers who can point to big proposals to solve the country's problems.
You know what's amazing about that, Molly, is I think there is a unified voice on some important parts of healthcare, and that's that it costs way too much, and businesses agree with that, and individuals agree with that, and people will sit around a table and say, be they Republican or Democrats or employers, we have to do something about that.
Aiming to try to do is to bring down healthcare costs, and there's even some evidence that that's already starting to happen through these sort of little unsexy reforms to things like payment models. And we'll see. I think it's going to take a long time till we know if that's successful in the long term. But, you know, the individual mandate is according to Democratic policy experts, it's a necessary component of the reform, but it is far from the whole thing. And the reforms that to the healthcare system that this administration has enacted, they go beyond even the so-called Obamacare bill itself. There was a lot built into the stimulus bill that Obama passed even earlier in his term that was aimed at healthcare innovation and trying to bring down costs. But it's such a big problem. It's going to be years before we know if there's been success at, quote unquote, bending the curve on healthcare costs.
1 minute left. One more call. Tom in Cedarburg. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to mention that I think one thing that's being missed is that a lot of good Americans are voting for Republicans and really voting against their best interests economically, for sure, maybe socially too, because the Republicans have poised themselves to be the religious party and pro-life, even though their policies really haven't borne that out. And I think the Democrats need to smarten up and to consider limiting abortion the way it's now, especially partial birth abortion. And I think if they did that, they'd be much more likely to win. Lastly, I think that Iowa has got to stop being the first state in the presidential elections cycle, and it should be a rotating basis. It's only fair for the rest of the states in that Iowa gets all these gimmies.
Okay, Molly.
Well, you know, a decade ago, I think you could say it was true that Republicans were winning the culture war and successfully campaigning on issues like abortion and gay marriage and putting Democrats on their heels. I would even include gun control in that same breath. These days, you see Democrats being much more aggressive and thinking they have the winning side of those issues as public opinion has evolved and the sort of way Democrats talk about those issues has gotten smarter. So in 2012, it was really Democrats waging the culture war, and I think we could say winning.
Molly, thank you ever so much for being with us. It was a lively hour, covered a lot of territory, and we appreciate your being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our pleasure. Molly Ball, our guest for All Things Political. Molly is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and she covers national politics. We thank her for her expertise, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. You are what make this show as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. We have news coming up momentarily, and then we'll return with another hour of programming, taking on the horrific violence in Milwaukee the last week.